This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode about kids and mental health. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. The pandemic has made life a lot more stressful for many young people. Rates of anxiety and depression went up, but those were already at high levels before the pandemic hit, so high that many mental health experts were starting to raise the alarm bells. A CDC report from last fall found that the rate of suicide among youth rose dramatically over the course of a decade between 2007 and 2018. And many researchers also got a big wake-up call in terms of who is affected by suicide.
When you find a finding like that, it's pretty eye-opening and, you know, your jaw drops.
That's Arielle Scheftal. She is a researcher at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. She says a closer look at the data showed that suicide is increasing among Black youth and rising faster than in other groups.
So I think, unfortunately, we have been dropping the ball, to be quite honest. And this change has been occurring, but we haven't really noticed it until recently. And I really do believe we are in a state of emergency.
Arielle and other researchers have been trying to find out what's causing the rise in depression and suicide among Black kids and teens and what to do about it. Liz Tung has more.
For a lot of families, finding out their kid is in crisis can come as a shock. For Lisa, who asked that we use pseudonyms to protect her family's privacy, the news came via a group text from her sister. Her nephew Jaden, who was 17 at the time, was in the hospital. His coworkers had noticed that he seemed out of it while working his part-time job.
I think falling asleep at some point, or what they thought was him falling asleep, but maybe he was losing consciousness then.
That's when his coworkers realized it looked like he was struggling to breathe. So they called 911. Over at the hospital, the family found out that Jaden had overdosed on an opioid. And that's when it all came flooding out. Jaden admitted that he'd been taking opioids since seventh grade, that he was depressed, and that he wanted to die.
So that was the first kind of introduction that there was like a major depression and suicidal thoughts with him.
It's something Lisa had never expected out of her nephew, who she remembers starting out as a little beam of sunshine.
As a kid, he was very talkative, very outgoing, just, you know, really smart. He was just very bubbly and friendly.
That started to change as Jaden got older. He became quieter, withdrawn almost. But Lisa figured that's normal, right?
You know, I think I just thought it was like, that's how you are when you're a teenager. You just like have an attitude.
Lisa says there were some family problems. She always felt that her sister's husband was too strict, to put it mildly. But nothing that prepared her for this new reality. That Jaden was depressed, that he'd been depressed for years, that he had a 5-year opioid addiction, and that he wanted to die. At the hospital, Jaden was treated for the overdose, but as far as Lisa knows, didn't get much or any help for his mental health. When families are plunged into crises like these, there is often the question of how did this happen? How do we not see this coming? Or who's to blame? But then comes the question of what do we do now? Where do we turn for help? The answer leads many families into a system that's both hard to navigate and where resources are scarce.
We struggle to meet the demand, and that's true across the city.
That's Tammy Benton, the psychiatrist in chief of the Children's Hospital Philadelphia, or CHOP, which sees hundreds of suicidal kids every year. She says the pandemic didn't just make things worse for the kids who were already struggling.
We started to see kids who were pretty much well before the pandemic, who became overwhelmed with those symptoms due to the social isolation, the lockdown, the fear, the family stress, all the things that happened during the pandemic.
Those factors were magnified among Black families who were hit especially hard by COVID, not to mention other stresses, like the news and the images of George Floyd's murder, which, thanks to social media, became inescapable for lots of kids. What all that meant is that CHOP and children's hospitals across the country saw a major spike in mental health crises, more than a lot of them could handle. Tammy says there just weren't enough resources.
And so those kids, more of those kids required hospitalization. And that's where the big problems really stood out this past year, is the long lines of kids waiting in the emergency departments for inpatient hospital beds. Families can be there for hours and sometimes even days. And so those kinds of scenarios prevent people from even seeking care.
Another big barrier standing in the way of Black families getting help is the lack of what researchers call cultural competency. Tammy says Black parents can often feel like they're not being treated with kindness, understanding, or even respect. She gave one example of a family she treated. It started out at a different emergency room. And the mother, who's a physician herself, said the very first thing doctors asked her when she brought her kid in,
if she'd ever been incarcerated, if she had ever had a drug problem. And she said before they even asked her all of the questions about her child's mental health, those were some of the questions that she was being asked. She said it was really, it felt incredibly disrespectful. And it compromised their trust from the beginning of the assessment.
For some parents, that cultural gap translates into a feeling of alienation.
So I think the two main things are, one, not being comfortable enough addressing the elephant in the room, and two, not taking a parent's culture and backgrounds into consideration, and somehow that being conveyed as parents feeling like they're being told that they're bad parents.
This is Aisha Metzger, a psychologist and researcher from Atlanta. She gave me a common example, spanking, which past studies have shown is more common among African-American parents.
If a caregiver says that they spank their kid, right, oftentimes what we as clinicians do is we tell caregivers the many, many reasons why we shouldn't be spanking our kids and why that's bad. What they're going to say is, well, you obviously know nothing about me and my family.
Aisha says that instead, therapists should ask parents why they spank their kids. Spend time learning about the context of their lives, the violent history of racism and police brutality, the everyday risks their children face.
The history that will lead Black parents to feel like they need to parent their kids more sternly, because they know that if they are noncompliant or combative or don't respond to requests in society, that they can get beaten, that they can get shot by police, that they can get written up in school.
Lisa says this cultural disconnect came up when she was trying to get help for her nephew, Jaden. She says the rest of the family had basically treated it like a stupid teenage mistake, a one-off. But over the next few months, Jaden overdosed again and again. Lisa tried to convince him to get into therapy, but she says his parents were reluctant.
The first time he wanted to go to therapy, it's like, you don't want these white people to know that we have problems.
She said Jaden also felt like he couldn't connect with a therapist.
I really felt like he needed someone his own race and possibly even gender. There was just a lot of disconnect, I think, between him and the therapist that they had chosen.
This is a huge problem everywhere. Black Americans make up 13% of the country, but only 5% of psychologists and only 2% of psychiatrists. What that means is that if you're looking for a therapist who'd be a great fit for, say, a Black male teenager, you're usually out of luck.
Finding Black male therapists is like the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my entire life.
This is Arielle Sheftall, a principal investigator at the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio.
I think that that is unfortunately one of the biggest barriers, is that we don't have therapists that are, number one, culturally competent in the things that Black youth experience on a regular basis. And I think that makes it harder for Black youth and their families to open up during therapy sessions and to be real, so to speak, on what they're thinking and what they're feeling.
It's only been a few years since researchers realized that the suicide risk among Black youth is on the rise, which means there are no solid answers yet on what's causing it or how we solve it. Still, I wanted to hear what experts have been thinking in terms of potential solutions. One of the first ones I heard was simply recognizing when Black kids need help. It happens way less often than you might think. A lot of times, Aisha Metzger, the Atlanta researcher, says, when Black kids are feeling intense depression or anxiety, it's not recognized, at least not for what it is.
What I'll say is that we often see those Black youth who are suicidal, but we don't see them as suicidal. We see them as deviant. We see them as angry. We see them as fill in the blank in how we pathologize and label them. And I think that as early as we're able to catch them and change them from those courses of actions, of thoughts, of feelings, then we're able to prevent and intervene upon suicidality.
Not only do adults need to recognize those red flags for what they are, they need to avoid the knee-jerk reaction of trying to punish Black kids for quote-unquote acting out, which can involve discipline at school or worse.
The police may be called, and handcuffs is the first way of kind of resolving it.
This is Mary May. She's a relationship therapist in Philadelphia who works with a lot of Black families and kids. She says there has to be a shift in how many Black families talk, or in a lot of cases, don't talk about mental health issues and who's affected by them. I asked her about a quote that I'd heard several times in reports and articles.
Suicide is a white person problem. Is that something that you've heard? Have you heard that like mental health issues, therapy, suicide is a white person problem?
Plenty. Yes, definitely throughout my years, I've heard that over and over again.
There's also a lot of stigma attached to mental health issues. Mary says that stigma has created what she calls a culture of silence in a lot of Black families, one that sometimes makes kids feel robbed of their ability to say what's really going on with them.
Well, in a sense, we are people who are of African-American descent or identify as Black American are always in the edge of trying to show that they are worthy, in a sense. And the prevalence of silence comes from a space of we don't want to make ourselves look bad, but we definitely don't want to make whomever our caregiver is embarrassed.
Mary says there have to be more open conversations about mental health issues. Another big solution I heard from experts again and again is the importance of expanding education about mental wellness, both for kids and their parents.
Simple things like socio-emotional learning curricula in the schools, and we're doing some of that work now, teaching kids how to express their feelings and how to talk about them, how to talk to trusted adults, and then being able to recognize when kids are struggling and then have something you actually can do about it. Because many providers will tell you sometimes they know kids are struggling, but they don't do anything because there's nothing available.
That's something both Tammy Benton and the researcher Arielle Scheftal have been working on, bringing programs to families who might otherwise not have the time or resources to get their kids help, which Arielle says is actually kind of a new idea.
Well, why can't we go to them and actually do services where they are versus having them always come to us all the time? So I think we have to really change our mindset about the services that we are providing and where we're actually providing those services. Why can't we do suicide prevention in community settings? Why can't we do that? We can. We just haven't. Why can't we do that at the Boys and Girls Club or the after-school program where Black youth are present? We can. We just haven't.
Finally, there's the aforementioned problem of cultural competency, or the lack thereof, which can destroy parents' trust in healthcare providers and make kids more unwilling to open up. Everyone agreed it would be amazing if we had more Black clinicians, but that goal is probably a ways in the future. In the meantime, Aisha Metzger says there's plenty white clinicians can do to connect better with Black clients. First and foremost being not to shy away from race, but to confront it head on.
If we're unwilling to talk about race, racism, family values, and culture, then our families are going to feel like, okay, you're only treating a very small percentage of my issues.
Aisha says therapists need to have the humility to be able to admit there are things about their clients, whether because of race or age, that they don't understand. When in doubt, she says, ask questions.
So I'm an expert in cognitive behavioral therapy, but I'm an adult. So I might say some things to you that let you know that I don't really get what it's like to be a teenager. If I say something that confuses you or offends you, or if you say something that confuses me, I want us to be able to talk about that, to ask questions, to say if you're offended. I certainly want you to know that my intentions, however, are to help you and to really get to know you and your experiences.
Lisa says finding treatment for Jaden has basically become like a second job for her. Finally, in June, after several more trips to the hospital, the family got him into an inpatient treatment clinic, and the results were encouraging. He told Lisa that it seemed to help. In fact, it was the first thing that gave him and his family hope that there was a light at the end of the tunnel. The problem was, it was expensive. So expensive that they couldn't afford to keep him there any longer than 3 weeks. They'd had to scrape the money together as it was to get him there. So the clinic released him. And once again, Jaden relapsed. There was another overdose, another near-death experience. Lisa says he eventually decided to leave town, move in with a friend in a different city, try to get away from it all, and focus on living sober. Lisa says the whole thing has been hard, not only for Jaden, but for the whole family. She says it feels like a constant threat hanging over their heads.
Just kind of feeling like I've been like spinning my wheels trying to just figure out how to best help him, because at the end of the day, it's like his being alive is more important than anything else. So it kind of like it's taken over a lot of my life, because I'm like, I don't want to slack on this and then something bad happens. So it's like it feels like it's do or die, and like it's, you know, it's like we have to figure out a plan before something bad happens.
Right as I wrapped up my reporting, I got a text from Lisa. Jaden got a scholarship to go back to the inpatient treatment program, and he says he's ready to go.
That story was reported by Liz Tong.